Chango.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to another episode of Tangentially Speaking. This is going to be Roman number 72. Roma 72. The 72nd time I have been ranting out my ass. And some people out there in the world are listening. I got an email today from... Well, I don't know if it's a man or a woman because the name was very confusing to me, but this person said that they are a trucker in Iran and they listen to this podcast while driving their truck in Iran. What a world. What a world. My voice, this voice that you're hearing is vibrating in the cab of a truck in Iran. I don't know whether to be honored or freaked out by that. So I'm just going to go with 50-50. I'm kind of honored and kind of freaked out. Anyway, welcome to this episode. There's a lot. You know, it's weird having a podcast like this because you go through life and things kind of present themselves as, oh, that's something I should talk about next time I do a Roma or in an intro to some episode. And, you know, sometimes I take notes and like, if you could see my computer screen right now, there are post-it notes stuck all over it talking about, you know, with ideas of things to talk about. But sometimes I look at it and I forget what it was, you know, it just says, you know, artist in Mexico. And I'm like, yeah, wait a minute, which artist was that in Mexico? And why did I want to talk about that? And yeah, it's interesting. One thing I wanted to mention to you, if you don't subscribe through Substack, one of the things you're missing out on is the monthly open thread, which I used to do pretty much just for, you know, paying subscribers. But last month I asked the paying subscribers, like, what do you think? Should I open this up to everyone? And most of them said, yeah, open it up. Let's, you know, let them in, those freeloaders. And if you don't know what an open thread is, it's basically just a post where people use the comment section to have a conversation. So it's kind of like a community space for people who listen to the podcast. And, yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome because it's one of the only spaces on the internet that I'm aware of where people are actually cool. It's kind of like, you know, what we were all hoping the internet was going to be 25 years ago when it was young and innocent. And we were saying things like, oh, it's going to make the world a better place because it's going to bring, you know, the sense of global community and you know, people are going to have access to all the information of the world and it's going to break down repressive governments because we can all talk to each other and form these grassroots networks. And yeah, it seems like a long time ago. You know, instead it's mostly dating apps and ways to make people feel badly about themselves and, you know, bullshit profiles that don't exist, just looking to troll and sow dissension. And yeah, you know the story. But on the other hand, my voice is resonating in a truck in Iran right now. So, and when I say right now, I mean the future. So confusing. So some good things did come of it. Why am I talking about that? The internet. God, I'm already lost. Anyway, the open chat, that's right. So it's one of the only spaces that is what we thought the internet was going to be, which is friendly and cool and smart and open-minded and, you know, people can discuss things without getting up on a soapbox and yelling and screaming and calling everyone else stupid. And it's fucking awesome. So whether you support the podcast financially or not, I invite you to subscribe on Substack, chrisryan.substack.com, and join the conversation. This month, it was I normally post some kind of question just to get the ball rolling, but you're welcome to ask advice or, just share things that you found recently that you think the community could be interested in, a movie, a book, a poem, a song, whatever it is. And anyway, what I posted this month, a couple days ago, was how seriously do you take global warming as a problem? And if you think it's a problem, what, if anything, are you doing about it? Because I find that a perplexing situation. Personally, I think it's very clear that it's happening. And, you know, I've been listening to scientists for 15 years saying it's not too late. It's almost too late, but it's not quite too late. And, you know, I think it's not too late are like famous last words. You know, it's never too late. Well, yes, it is. Sometimes it's too late. You know, never give up hope. Yeah, sure. You know, take that mentality to the casino, right? You'll walk out of there without your wedding ring. Sometimes hope is a problem. It's the best thing to give up. Give up hope. Stop doing that. It's not working. And, you know, it's never too late. Yeah, it is. Sometimes it's too late. And I kind of feel like that's where we are now. It's too late. And also, I mean, it's not too late, like we're all going to die tomorrow, but it's too late to stop the processes that are going to result in, you know, extreme hurricanes, extreme storm systems, water levels rising significantly, possibly currents, global ocean currents slowing or stopping with all kinds of downstream consequences to that, massive die-offs in various parts of the ocean and land. And that stuff's all happening, and I don't really think that there's anything that's going to change it. Because also, it's not just too late in terms of, you know, all the carbon that's already in the atmosphere, which, if I remember correctly, like, it hasn't been this high in 200 million years. Like, 200, that's like dinosaurs and shit, you know? But also, our ancestors, by the way, when the dinosaurs ruled the planet, our ancestors were these little, like, squirrel things. That's what evolved into us. That's how long ago it was. Before such a thing as primates existed. So I do think that those processes are moving forward no matter what. But I also don't see any evidence that we as a species are capable of making collective decisions for long-term gain if they come at a short-term cost. I don't think we have mechanisms to do something like that. You know, like the way things are, the sort of dominant control mechanism in our world is capitalism. And capitalism is like short-term profit. Quarterly reports on Wall Street is what it's all about. It's not even long-term profit anymore. It's, you know, unless you have a startup or something and then you're raising money with the promise that you're going to make gazillions in a few years. But I don't see how capitalism is capable of arriving at any kind of decision that's for the good of humanity. You've heard me say this a million times probably, right? Corporations are organisms, and like all organisms, they are operating according to their short-term benefit. And I don't see any mechanism. I see this in the conversation about AI, right? There are all these articles like, well, should we slow it down or should we restrict it or should we do this or should we do that? I question the premise that it was, should we can't. What do you mean we? Who's we? Who's we? We're going to, California is going to pass a law saying, you know, AI cannot move forward. How long do you think it's going to take till the companies doing this work, you know, set up shop in Nevada or Singapore? It'll be hours. And it'll just be a question of filing some paperwork. Nobody's even going to have to go anywhere. It's nonsense. There's no way that we, whatever that means, are going to restrict AI development if it means profit. If there's money on the table, then that money's going to rule. That's the way it's always been. And I don't see anything changing. So call me whatever, pessimist, curmudgeon, whatever I am, guilty as charged. But in the meantime, show me a few examples of where humanity, we have made short-term sacrifice for long-term gain. Not since the advent of capitalism, you know, maybe hunter-gatherer groups. There's the story about how the Iroquois, when they were making a collective decision, I think it was six generations into the future. Like, that's what they would look, they would say, okay, how is this going to affect our descendants six generations into the future? That those are the parameters by which we should make this decision. I don't know if that's true, but that's something I've read. By the way, the American government system is to a large extent based upon the Iroquois Nation governmental system with separate chambers, different councils that all had to agree on something before a decision was taken. Apparently, Benjamin Franklin was very interested in the Iroquois government system, and he incorporated that three branches of government that all had collective ability to neutralize the others, veto policy. He got that from the Iroquois, apparently. I went to Spain last week. Not really a pleasure trip, more of a bureaucracy, paperwork, lawyers and notaries and that kind of thing. But when I landed, I was staying with my friend Martin. I think I mentioned in the last episode, Martin is Dutch. He's very Dutch. His name is Martin van Dijvendijk, which I think means, van Dijvendijk means the pigeon on the dike. So, you know, like, how Dutch can you get? Anyway, Martin's a wonderful friend who I've known for a long time. And one of the first things he said to me when he picked me up at the airport was, did you hear about Franz? I hadn't. And I guess, being Dutch, he heard about the death of Franz de Waal before everyone else did, before it got into the international papers. Anyway, those of you who don't know who Franz de Waal was, he was someone whose work was very important to me. He was one of the only primatologists who studied bonobos and talked openly about bonobos, published lots of books, and really did a lot of work to bring bonobos to the attention of the world, because the scientific community had more or less been ignoring bonobos for decades because they were embarrassed by them. Because bonobos fuck. That'd be a good t-shirt. Bonobos fuck. Bonobos fuck a lot. And they have sex for non-reproductive purposes. You can see how that was obviously a very important fact for me in developing the theories for Sex at Dawn. I think it was Franz who told me the story about some television station, American station, hiring him to sort of help produce a segment that they were doing. It might have been 60 Minutes or Nightline or one of those network shows about bonobos. And they flew to Congo and set up their cameras, and he took them to the jungle where the bonobos were, and they were filming them, and the bonobos were doing what they do, which is, you know, being super social and friendly and rubbing their genitals together. And at some point, one of the producers said to Franz, like, hey, you know, when are they going to stop doing this? We can't use this footage. And Franz was like, what do you mean? Stop. That's what they do. They're this hypersexual species. They almost always are doing some sort of genital contact. It's how they greet each other and resolve conflict and, you know, keep stress down. And the guy's like, well, damn, we can't show this on TV. He just flew all the way to Africa, and they didn't know that they couldn't use any of it. So I guess the segment never aired. Franz famously said, bonobos use sex to avoid violence, whereas chimps use violence to get sex. The importance of bonobos cannot be overstated for understanding human nature and human societies. Every time you hear someone say, or you read in some article, the primate origins of war go very deep into our past, or the primate origins of rape, or the primate origins of male dominance of females, or the primate origins of violence or infanticide. Stop that person. Call them on their bullshit, because humans are equally related to chimps and bonobos. I apologize to those of you who've heard me say this a million times, but it's one of those things I can repeat it as much as, you know, till the day I die. But still, this idea that humans are evolved from chimps, that chimps are our closest primate relatives, is so ubiquitous, so generalized, so infused into the cultural narrative, that the fact that all primatologists know that's bullshit, that that's telling half of a story and calling it the story, it doesn't seem to matter, because it reinforces the dominant narrative. And there is nothing as hard to change as a narrative that serves the interests of the powerful. And the narrative that the human species is innately violent, that all men are rapists, that we're all killers, that we're all these Hobbesian monsters, only kept in check by governmental, religious, corporate institutions that keep us from ripping each other apart. That narrative serves those interests very well. It keeps us divided against each other. It keeps us suspicious of ourselves. It keeps us ashamed. It keeps us neutralized. It cuts our legs out from under any kind of political organization, because it's just naive to think that we could live together in peace. It's naive to think that you could have sex with someone without it ending in disaster. It's naive to think that you could have sexual friendships that don't end in screaming and crying and abuse. Because if you look at chimps, yeah, that it doesn't work with chimps. But you look at bonobos, it all works with bonobos. And as I said, we are equally related to chimps and bonobos. The three of us are basically three types of chimpanzee. We're more closely related to chimps and bonobos than the Indian elephant is to the African elephant. So don't let anyone tell you that human nature is a reflection of chimpanzees, unless they mention bonobos. Human nature is a reflection of chimpanzees and bonobos. We can go both ways. Anyway, Franz de Waal was a beautiful man. And this is a story I've told before, but it's a story I'll tell again now, that he's died at 75 from stomach cancer. I didn't know he was ill. I've had him on the podcast twice, I think, and I've met him. I've spent time with him maybe 4 or 5 times. Anyway, I have a, how can I really explain this? I have a suspicion about Franz, and I have no way of knowing whether this is true or not. But I think Franz was waiting for someone to write Sex at Dawn. And he certainly could have written it. But like Darwin, I think he felt that there were a lot of reasons for him not to write it. I don't know what his marriage was like. I don't know what his family life was like. I know he taught at Emory University and had written a bunch of books and was a very well-respected scholar and author. And for him to write a book saying that human sexual nature is quite like the bonobo, probably would have had professional repercussions for him that were not worth risking. And I always had the sense with him that when we met, there was this feeling of he was looking at me like I was wondering who it would be. There was this, and again, I'm probably just projecting. I have no idea if this is true. But it always confused me that he didn't write that book, that he didn't. He was so close. He was like standing at the threshold of making the arguments that we made in Sex at Dawn, and he had all the data, more than me by far, and yet he never took that step. So the story I wanted to tell you is that when I was working on Sex at Dawn, I had the contract, the publishing contract, so I knew it was actually going to come out, and I was using so much of the research that Franz and others had done concerning bonobo sexual behavior and anatomy and social behavior and all this. And yet I was disagreeing with his conclusions. And in fact, I had written this whole section where I took a few pages from one of his books and just quoted him verbatim and made it like a dialogue. So he says something and then I respond for a paragraph and then I quote the next thing and I respond to that. And it ended up not going into the book. My editor didn't like it. And I felt squeamish about it too, because it was like I was, it felt unfair somehow, because I was calling attention to how he was presenting the evidence and then turning away from the obvious conclusion. So it felt like I was ridiculing him a little bit. Anyway, because I felt weird about it, I found his email and I sent him an email and I said, it was to him, Helen Fisher, and one other scientist. I forget who it was. But I sent the same email to the three of them saying, look, I am writing this book. It's coming out. It's published by HarperCollins. It's, you know, so it's going to, it's not just some guy thinking he's writing a book. This is actually going to happen. And I'm quoting you a lot. I'm using a lot of your research, but I disagree with your conclusions about the, you know, innate quality of monogamy for human beings. And, but because I respect your work so much, I really want to be sure I'm being fair to you, and I'm not, you don't think I'm quoting you out of context or whatever. And so if you'd like to see the relevant sections of the book, I'd be happy to send them to you, and you can tell me if I'm off base or whatever. One of the scientists didn't write back. Helen Fisher did write back, and she said something really weird. Like, she said something like, "My ideas are my children. I'll defend them to the death." Like, what the fuck, lady? That's not how science works. But okay. And so, in other words, fuck off. But Franz wrote back, and he said, "Yeah, I'd like to see what you're doing." So I sent him the relevant passages, and he wrote back to me, and he said, "Oh, this is interesting. Have you read this paper by so and so, and have you considered this aspect of the?" And I wrote back, and like, "Yes, I've read that paper, and oh no, I didn't hear about this, and but I looked it up, and this is interesting, and da da da." And we sort of had this very civil exchange over the course of a couple of weeks. And then he wrote back and he said, "Well, you know, you seem to understand all the research, and you're familiar with everything. And who knows, maybe you're right. These are the kinds of questions that need to be asked." And I'm going to get a copy of Sex at Dawn here. And the reason I'm getting a copy is that I said to Franz, "Well, thank you. That's very generous of you. Could I quote you publicly saying that?" And he wrote back and said, "Sure you can. You can use it as a blurb on the book if you want." So here's a guy who I write to say, "I'm writing a book disagreeing with you, disagreeing with what you have spent your life researching, what you have published in half a dozen books at that time, at that point, and you've never heard of me. I'm some upstart dipshit who's never written a book and is not a primatologist at all." And he takes the time to engage with me, checks me out, and when he realizes that I've done the work, I know what I'm talking about, he has the humility and generosity of spirit to say, yeah, maybe you're right. And yes, you can put my name on your book." And here it is on the back of Sex at Dawn. "You clearly have an exciting book on your hands, whether people agree with it or not. These are issues that will need debating over and over before we will arrive at a resolution. Franz Duval, Director of the Yerkes National Primate Research Center." That, my friends, is a scientist and a mensch. That's a guy who is more interested in conversation and moving things forward than in protecting his ideas, his reputation, his status, whatever. That's a beautiful man. Next to Franz Duval on my post-it notes is Andrew Huberman. Now, some of you, a lot of you, probably most of you don't know who Andrew Huberman is, or don't care, or have not read the article that came out last week, basically trashing him. It was a real hit piece in New York Magazine about Andrew Huberman. I met him years ago at a party in north of San Francisco at a friend's place. This was after I got to know Wim Hof and his family, and they were looking for scientists who would do research into the things that Wim was able to do and the physiological feats that he was able to help other people achieve. Because Wim's not a scientist. Wim is a practitioner and a teacher, but he was, you know, doing crazy stuff like, you know, increasing immune response radically and obviously withstanding extreme cold and, you know, doing all this stuff that is supposedly not possible for the human body to do. And so he was looking for reputable scientists to do this kind of research, so that he wasn't, you know, just a flash in the pan weirdo. He was actually someone teaching techniques that were useful for humanity. And so my idea, I have this friend, who is a very wealthy Silicon Valley investor kind of guy. And, he's a good dude. And so I said to him, like, hey, what if we had a party where you invited your billionaire friends and we have Wim Hof there and they could meet and maybe some of these people would, you know, want to invest in setting up a lab or something, you know? And so he thought it was a good idea and everybody wanted to meet Wim. So we set up this party at my friend's house and, it was a funny party. A lot of weird things happened that night. I remember, you know, billionaires aren't a lot of fun in my experience. I can't tell you, I know a lot of them, or not, maybe not billionaires, 100 millionaires or, you know, 50 millionaires or whatever they are. You know, insanely wealthy California dude bro types. Pretty dull. But anyway, everyone's standing around at this party, and my friend whose house it was, he had a little kid at the time who was maybe like 4 or 3. And basically Wim spent pretty much the whole party just chasing this kid around, and the kid's just running and Wim's like, I'm coming to get you. And all these stuffed shirts, stick up your ass, you know, millionaires there to meet the great Wim Hof are just watching him chase this kid around and have fun with the kid. And Wim was pretty much ignoring all the rich people and, you know, he wasn't schmoozing. So I don't think that worked really well, but Andrew Huberman was there. So that's where I met him. And I remember he invited me down to Stanford and we were going to do a podcast, but it never happened. And that was before he was on Rogan. I guess maybe I had been on Rogan a bunch at that point. And so maybe Huberman saw me as a route to Rogan, as many people have over the years. The road to Rogan goes through Ryan. It doesn't, by the way. I think I've sent Joe maybe like 3 or 4 people that I thought could be good guests for him. And he only followed up. Well, no, he followed up with 2. And both of them, I think, were kind of disastrous. One was this dominatrix. I forget what her name was. Sierra something. Anyway, I had her on my podcast, and she was a humiliatrix. And I remember telling Joe about her and how she was quite smart and, you know, had sort of an interesting take on things. Anyway, he ended up getting her, Sierra Lynch. Yeah, he got her on the podcast and it was terrible. They talked for maybe 20 minutes or something. And Joe was just like, okay, well, thanks for coming. And just like, just ended it. It was not good. And then the other one was Dan Savage, which again, Joe seemed very uncomfortable. I enjoyed it. I listened to it and I love Dan Savage. I think he's one of the coolest guys alive, but it seemed like From my perspective, it seemed like Joe was confused because he was faced with a gay alpha male and he just didn't know how to handle a guy who was both gay and extremely, you know, powerful masculine presence. I think Joe just got really confused by that. And so after those two, I think, you know, when I sent Joe a recommendation, I think he just went right in the trash. I don't think he really was interested. But anyway, so this article about Andrew Huberman basically demonstrates that he was fucking a bunch of different women and lying to them all. And they all thought they were the only one or... yeah. And he was, you know, is this piece like gets into phone records. And what happened was that some of the women ended up like finding each other and got together and like, wait a minute, on April 7th, he was with you. He told me he was visiting his mother. And, you know, just like all the secrets came out. And it's, I mean, to me, it was interesting, not because I give a shit necessarily. I mean, I'm not an Andrew Huberman fan. Those of you who still don't know who I'm talking about, he's a neuroscientist at Stanford and he has a very popular podcast. You know, he's like one of those sort of, you know, hyper intelligent scientific dude bros who can, you know, is like selling, you know, human optimization shit, you know, like he's got his supplements and he's got his morning routines and his, you know, whatever, all that kind of shit that's going to make you superhuman and live forever. So he's one of those guys. He's in the pantheon of podcast gods. And I've never listened to his podcast. I think I listened to 20 minutes of it once and it just, I found it tedious. And boring, and I don't give a shit. I don't want to live forever, and I don't want to be totally optimized. I like being moderately optimized at most. Anyway, what gets me about these stories is, like, it's the same with Tiger Woods and yeah, a lot of other people. It's like, the great tragedy of these things is you don't need to lie. You don't need to. But again, the dominant narrative is so powerful. And the dominant narrative is that no woman will love you or accept you if you don't present to her the, at least the image that you are monogamous and you really just want to be with her and she's the only one. No woman will accept less than that. That's the narrative. It's false. I can tell you it's false. I can tell you from personal experience, from years of research, that's false. But that's the narrative. And so we get these people who lie in order to experience erotic novelty, and those lies end up blowing up in their faces and they pay huge divorce settlements or they get humiliated on a cover story in New York Magazine. Totally unnecessary. Andrew Huberman is rich enough, famous enough, smart enough, good-looking enough, charismatic enough that he could have said to women, hey, I'm not monogamous, but I'm honest, and this is my deal, and I'd love to see you, but I totally get it. If you're not down with this, you know, you're looking for a husband or, a, you know, a boyfriend or whatever, I totally get it. That's not on the table for me. You could have done that. If you'd had some balls, dude, you could have had that conversation, and I guarantee you that you would have found lots of women, really cool, really smart, really beautiful women who would have been down with that. On the other hand, you'd have to be man enough to accept the fact that you're not the only dude in their life. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe you don't want to accept that things work in both directions. And so he lied. And he was fucking six or seven women at a time and lying to all of them and juggling. He had different phones, different phone numbers, different email accounts, like the whole, he had this whole house of cards. For what, dude? None of those women even know you. None of those women know who you really are. So if they say, I love you, it doesn't mean anything because they don't know you. That's what kills me. I wouldn't know how to even set it up, but if I could have some sort of like a consultancy where these like rich, successful people, if I could just sit them down for an hour or two and kind of, you know, slap some fucking sense into them, you don't need to lie. In fact, you shouldn't lie. Not because it's bad, not because God's watching you, not because there's some, you're going to go to hell, but because it totally sabotages your own possibility for happiness and intimacy. If you're lying, you will never experience intimacy, because intimacy, by definition, can only happen if you are being transparent about who you are. And if something about who you are makes you so uncomfortable that you're going to lie about it, then you're just spinning your wheels. You're not going to get intimacy. You're never going to get away from feeling isolated and alone unless you turn your attention to whatever it is in you that you're so ashamed of and either work through that, if it can be worked through, or learn to live with it and learn to stop being ashamed of it. If it's nothing to be ashamed of, if it is something to be ashamed of, you fucking deal with it. If it isn't something to be ashamed of, stop being ashamed of it. Anyway, yeah, that's my Andrew Huberman rant. You could have had it all, man. You could have had it all. All right. I'm going to end the free version of this with a song that someone sent in, and I hope it won't get flagged on Spotify. Most songs do, and this song is available on Spotify, so maybe it will. Nobody gives a shit that the artist, you know, gave me permission to play the song. It's lawyers and labels and, I mean, the Carsey Blanton song. You know, she actually recorded an acoustic version just for my podcast. And still, if it goes up on YouTube, it gets flagged. So maybe this song will get flagged. If it does, I'll pull this down and remove it and repost it. But this is Turncoat Syndicate. A guy named Matt is in the band, and he sent this. I guess he listens to the podcast. Hey, Matt. And the song is called Past Mistakes, Turncoat Syndicate. I hope you enjoy it. Those of you who are paying subscribers, I'll be back after the song. Those of you who are freeloaders, love you. Love you just the same. But this will be the end of the podcast for you. So thanks for listening. And I will talk with you again either in a few days or in a few minutes.